Hello and welcome to, I don't know what we'll describe this. It's a new series of podcasts, so welcome to Cooper Talks. And the first in a little series I'm going to be doing, looking at the Russian Revolution. So looking at 20th century Russia, particularly looking at the collapse of the Tsarist regime, the revolutions of 1917, then the Bolsheviks gaining power, the Civil War, Stalin's rise to power, collectivization, really taking us up to 1941. The intention of this is really for the GCSE course, for those of you doing the LXL GCSE course in Russia, which focuses 1917 to 41. But I'm going to be going a little beyond that and using these first few episodes kind of to contextualize why the revolution broke out in 1917. So while those of you doing a GCSE in the subject may not get an exam question, well, you won't get an exam question specifically on any of these aspects, they are points that will help you answer a question on the causes and outbreak of the revolution in February 1917 and the reason that had problems. It will also give a bit of general background information for those interested in learning about pre-revolutionary Russia, and maybe some revision and help for those who do other courses and possibly even the A level. But let's start. Now, obviously, this is all sort of, I'm looking at it very much as the history. It is not in any way a comment on modern Russia, good or bad, whatever it might be. Very much here, I'm just looking at the history of the events and kind of giving the story and the information to help people understand what went on and why it happened. And the first thing to know about Russia before the revolutions, and in many ways we can go back, Russia was, Russia had kind of emerged into the European scene, or the European consciousness, I suppose, around the end of the 16th, well, around the end of the 17th and start of the 18th century. Now, it had been opened up before then. They call it opening up by Elizabethan traders. There was a great voyage there where English people, there was a trade deal. They were meant to be going to Asia and like to India to get spice trade and stuff, but they ended up going to Russia. Obviously, that's a bit off course at this stage, but they signed a treaty and Russia had lots of forests at this time, which is good for wood, particularly big trees for building big ships, which the English were very fond of. But Russia, having the Rus, as they were, having been kind of a slave colony, a Slavic slave colony, under the Mongols for centuries, they'd thrown them off and established a sort of duchy of Muscovy around Moscow. And from there, it had been gradually expanding, gaining greater freedoms and independence. And so people like Ivan IV, Ivan the Terrible, as he's known, were known. But Russian culture and identity had developed very differently from Europe. Now, what happens at the end of the 17th century is Peter I becomes Tsar, part of the Romanov family. And he becomes Tsar Peter the Great. And he really has a drive to modernise Russia. And he wants to bring Russia very much into the European fold, and kind of goes against the more traditional old-style nobility based around Muscovy, or Moscow, as we usually call it, but looking to kind of break those traditions and kind of take Russia into a more modern world to make it richer, more established, and more competitive with other European countries. There's this great moment where he symbolically cut the beards of the old guard. He moved the capital from Moscow, very far inland, to his newly founded city that he named after his namesake patron saint, St. Peter, so St. Petersburg, made that the capital city. And it's very much modelled on Amsterdam, where Peter the Great had worked as a young man. There's a whole story there that I'm not going to go into right now. And that had become the capital, and he tried to he'd certainly come onto the scene during the Great Northern Wars. This was kind of the moment where Russia destroyed the country of Poland, Lithuania. Sweden was knocked back. Gustavus Adolphus was knocked back at the Battle of, Pavlova? Or was it it was Pavlova. Yes, not to be confused with the dessert. I think there's some connection, but I'm not sure what it is. Anyway, but Battle of Pavlova, kind of secured Russian dominance over the eastern parts of Europe and kind of set Russia up on the course. And the Tsars had been immensely powerful. And really, in a sense, that hadn't changed since Peter the Great's time. Now, Peter the Great, as a powerful autocratic Tsar, was nothing particularly unusual in Europe at that time. We're talking around 1700. Okay, so King Louis the 14th in France. You had various the kings of Spain, although weakening power, King of Portugal, although sometimes also the King of Spain. Apart from the English monarchy, which was still very, very powerful at this time, but was limited to a degree by Parliament and the Magna Carta. But apart from that, really, rulers remained largely autocratic, meaning the leader had all the power and all the say to do whatever they liked. Now, Russia had that, but even more so. And to give a demonstration, although this was before Peter the Great, people would travel to the court of Ivan the Fourth, known as Ivan the Terrible, and they were just amazed because of the kind of godlike power that he had. By godlike, I mean the way he was perceived by people, because he would order one of his subjects to jump out of a window to certain death, and they would do it. They would follow his command. He had that much control and power over his people. And while Western European monarchs certainly had a lot of power and authority and were the bosses, the idea that they could command someone to jump out of a window to their death was alien to them. It kind of shocked people. And although Peter the Great had tried to push Russia in this more modern direction, and he'd done a very good job on that, it also came at a bit of a price. And the price that most people have is, as you kind of modernise and you create new ideas and new academic experiments and people start discussing and sharing ideas, it does tend to, in history, coincide with a growth in, I suppose we call it democracy, but certainly people wanting to have greater freedoms, challenging authority, and becoming more independently minded. And this had been a problem, because while the Tsars that followed Peter wanted to modernise, and they wanted to emulate Britain and then France and Germany and those other countries across the 18th and 19th centuries that had been modernising and industrialising, they'd also seen that in the process of modernising, in developing factories and machine processes, it had created an expanded sort of middle class, if we look at it through class politics, and a stronger, more powerful gentry, we might call it. But this sort of middle class, so above peasants, and a challenge to nobility, and nobility even embracing these reforms. And it had made the country very wealthy and given them huge amounts of power, particularly in terms of industrial production of things like cannons and weapons and gunpowder and things like that, machinery parts. It allowed Britain to really develop its empire, and obviously Britain was seen, obviously not very good in modern sense, but at the time Britain was the dominant force, had become incredibly rich and incredibly powerful thanks to these advances. France was trying to copy it, as was Germany. But Russia lagged a long way behind in many ways. And the Tsars wanted to have all the benefits of industrialisation, but they were particularly scared of some of the associated risks. That actually, if you look, when various countries had taken part in these developments and allowed ideas to develop and be discussed and promoted university education and given people these rights and freedoms, in a number of occasions it had led to various revolutions and challenges to the authority of the monarch. And that was something Tsars didn't want. And obviously when you then in 1789 had the French Revolution, and you had other challenges, and then in 1848 you had a wave of revolutions across Europe, in all the countries in middle Europe that were trying to industrialize and develop, challenging the old order, the old way of doing things. There was a big conservative reaction across Europe, and particularly in Russia. The Tsars viewed these freedoms, this university education, the challenging of old traditional ideas, these things that allowed for industrial advancement, also came with a huge price. And the Tsars really hadn't been fans of those. So the Tsars had restricted free speech, free association of ideas. They tried to restrict people in in Russia. So there was this thing called serfdom, which had been abolished but got brought back. It's not exactly slavery, but it means peasants are bound to the land. They're not free to move or travel or sell their labor. They have to work for their landlord, the landowner, and they're not free to make their own choices. So it's not slavery, but it's also not freedom. And so while that had disappeared across Europe, Russia had actually reintroduced it in the 19th century. And that goes back to a fundamental problem that Russia had geographically. Vast area of land, but not enough people to work the land, even where it was workable, for farming materials. And because the population was so spread out, and you needed to keep people on the land working, you didn't get the influx to the cities that had driven industrialization and modernization by developing big pools of labor that could be then harnessed in factories and used to develop factory processes and develop all the machinery that we know. So, in that sense, Russia throughout the 19th century had been falling behind. And at the same time, the Tsars had become very centered around St. Petersburg, and they'd seen to a degree their rule, their authority being challenged, okay, by people attempting reforms, and they'd tried to weave a course between resisting this or denying it. One of Tsar Nicholas II's ancestors, Alexander II, his grandfather, he tried to introduce these great reforms, ending serfdom. Well, that had happened already, but then also trying to give greater freedoms to try and stimulate them. And that hadn't gone particularly well. It hadn't really encouraged economic development, and the Tsar Alexander II was actually assassinated. By someone who'd been given political freedom. And the church that looks like Basil's Cathedral, with the sort of round domes, built on the site where he was murdered in St. Petersburg, the Church of the Sacred Hearts, quite a famous image, that was built. And that it stands out in St. Petersburg because that's very much a reference to old traditional Eastern Russia as opposed to the reforms that were trying to Europeanize or Westernize Russia. So it was kind of a statement by the old guard, and his son Alexander III, who took over, Nicholas II's father, saw a big conservative reaction. So the great reforms that had been attempted were quickly brought forth, and really Russian farming methods and peasant methods were kind of what they had been 400 or 500 years earlier. They hadn't moved on in the way that other European countries were with new techniques and new machinery. And so Russia really wasn't able to produce enough food for itself, and the peasants, I mean, it grew plenty of food, but it couldn't always access that food or get it to the right places. Another big problem that it had was industrialization. Because it hadn't had that pull to the cities, because there wasn't this surplus population, and because people weren't given the freedom to share ideas and to experiment and do things, it was a very controlled and restrictive society. Where capable people, it wasn't a meritocracy. Now, there's debates about how meritocratic other parts of the world actually were, but the point was someone from lower middle class background, someone with a bit of money, a bit of education, could develop ideas and start up new factories and new businesses and take risks. And that's kind of the lucky ones had made a success of industrialization in the West. But in Russia, they didn't allow that because of the fear that it would lead to revolution. As a result of which, Russia was industrially a long way behind the West, and that posed a huge security threat. Because as the 19th century goes on, you've got Western countries producing battleships. They're obviously tanks come along a lot later, but more military equipment, armor-plated carts and things. They can machine-produce guns and artillery guns as well as rifles. Even machine guns will start to come along. They can mass-produce bullets and shells on a scale the Russians just can't compete with. On top of that, they've got the development of railways and steam engines, so transport is faster, which means food production is more efficient. All these benefits were lacking in Russia, and the Tsar wanted this. They wanted the industrialization. But they tried to force it to happen in Russia. But the problem with that was by trying to force it was very artificial and it didn't evolve organically. And as a result of that, there were gaps and there were problems with the process, and quite often it was just about producing one thing, and that was a military equipment, but that wasn't sustainable as a model. So there wasn't the investment or the support or the freedom for Russia to have industrialized under the Tsarist regime. Now, although it was still very sparsely populated, population growth was happening across Russia at this time in the 19th century. And that was putting more and more pressure on food production. Russia has a lot of land, but a lot of it is not suitable for farming because of the harsh conditions. And a lot of it hadn't been really developed. So again, the growth in population should have led to the development of cities, but because of the reintroduction of serfdom and because of the pressures on food, this actually caused greater hardship, and movement was actually restricted to keep more and more people in the countryside, trying to grow more and more crops, which is a bit of a problem. Another big issue that they had in Russia before all this got going was the problem of different nationalities. Now, Russia is huge, and the Russian Empire expanded all the way from parts of what is modern Poland, Ukraine, Belarus, Moldova, parts of Romania, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. Finland would become part of it, or was part of Russia, as well as all the various Asian parts. So you've got Georgia as well, you've got Chechnya, which is part of Russia. Well, there's a whole civil war there. Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Kazakhstan, all these different places. And a lot of them want, there was a growing sense in the 19th century of wanting their own country. Okay, so the Poles wanting land for the Poles, Poland. The same with a lot of European countries demanding this. And the sense that these people who mainly lived on the European borders were kind of more loyal to other countries than they were to Russia. And so there was this sort of drive to Russification, to promote the Russian language, Russian education, and so on. And that had some success, but it also caused some alienation, because by attacking people's ethnic backgrounds, the ethnic minorities, it made them almost prouder of their diversity and their differences. And it marked out something different between the Rus and the rest of the population of Russia that caused a big divide and a lot of resentment. Also, there was an irony, because most of the nobility, including the Romanov dynasty, they couldn't actually speak Russian. A sign of sophistication was that you spoke French. A lot of modern Russian words are actually French in origin. So it was this bizarre thing that they couldn't actually speak with the native Russian population because they were schooled in French and they thought Russian was coarse. So you've got this big disconnect at the top between the Tsar and the nobility. It's a very rigid society, very controlled. And compared to the West, it's politically and economically and industrially a long way behind. And this is becoming a source of great concern, particularly to the Tsar. And while they want to have that industrialization, they want to modernize and have a modern army to defend itself, maybe even to attack if needed. But they didn't want to have the associated weakening of Tsarist power. And that meant when, in, I think it was 1894, Tsar Nicholas II inherits from his father, he carries on a very conservative style reign. There's no reforms. He's married to the Tsarina Alexandria, who's actually German in origin, and she becomes super orthodox Russian. There's always a rule of thumb, the most ardent nationalists tend to be immigrants. They sort of have to out-Russian the native Russians, just as in Britain, quite often immigrants are the most patriotically British people, because they have to show their pride to feel accepted. There's a whole psychological thing there. Anyway, you've got this big dry, this big thing, but Tsar Nicholas II is, to be fair, a pretty ineffectual ruler. He's not educated, he's not a sophisticated person, he's not an intellectual person. His father had been rigid and strict. He wasn't really that sort of an imposing figure. He was a devoted family man, loved his family. He very much believed in Russia and Russian greatness, and he believed in his own divine right. He believed he answered only to God, and he'd been put on earth to rule Russia and make Russia great. But he lacked the skills to make this a reality. And so his weakness in leadership is going to be a big problem. Now, things came to a head in 1904-1905. Okay, so there have been lots of groups. Now, Russia did not have political parties, okay, because it was all governed. There was no parliament. There was no body. Basically, the Tsar ruled and made all the decisions. And he, yes, he would have a court and nobles could advise him, but it all came down to the Tsar. And it was whatever the Tsar decided to do. There were no rights. There were no freedoms. There was no way for the people to express their opinions and ideas. That, coupled with some economic issues and poor harvests and terrible working conditions in St. Petersburg, led to a revolution in 1905. Now, just to give a bit of background to this, the Tsar's control, there was a great theory, I can't remember what the official name was or who came up with it, but there's a theory that basically the Tsar's control, or Tsarist control, over Russia rested on five key principles, and that was the nobility, the law, the okhrana, which were the secret police the Tsar used, the army, and the Orthodox Church. And as long as all five were loyal, then the Tsar could rule in an autocratic style. Okay, so as long as he had those five tools under his belt, he was fine. Now, in 1904, there'd been what's called the Russo-Japanese War. Japan had been industrializing rapidly and looking to expand into sort of the Korean and Manchurian areas, and that led to conflict with Russia. And there was a big war in 1904 to 1905. And to everyone's surprise, except the Japanese perhaps, the Russians were, well, basically beaten. The Japanese, with more advanced technology, caught them unawares. There were problems with the military command because it was all based on the nobility rather than on merit. There was problems with the supply lines because the fighting was going on the eastern coast, on the Pacific coast, okay, over by the Chinese Korean border. So that's where this place called Port Arthur was. And the only way, most of the Russian technology and materials were in the west, on the European side, and the only link was the Trans-Siberian Railway, which is one track that ran all the way there. So it was slow, there were supply line issues, and basically the bulk of the Russian army got sort of penned up over in Asia. This created hardship and opposition. It then led to a strike of the railway workers, which basically ended up closing down the Trans-Siberian Railway. So the army stuck over in Asia, and none of the food and supplies from Siberia are now getting into the cities, which causes economic hardship. Now, this means that in 1905, the army is effectively out of action. So if you think of those five, the army's having a wobble. The army's kind of temporarily out of action. And so the Tsar cannot use the army and military force to suppress when rebellions in St. Petersburg kick off in 1905. And they will soon spread. So the cause of that was basically people were hungry. Leon Trotsky was actually around, more of him later. But he'd organised a Soviet, trying to organise a workers' council. So all the workers could get together to try and compete and put pressure on the Tsar for more reforms, better paying conditions for the workers and so on. That was a working class part of the movement, urban workers. But the peasants demanded better pay and better recognition. But there was also very much a middle-class uprising, which believed that industrialization would come from education and from having freedoms and democracy with a parliament and rights and things like that. It all kicked off, and there was a protest on a Sunday where people went to the Winter Palace, where the Tsar wasn't actually, and some of the Cossacks that were guarding it opened fire, killed some of them. It's known as Bloody Sunday. And that basically led to full-on rioting across Russia, but mainly in the cities. And with the army away, the Tsar couldn't bring them in to just crush the revolt. So he was having problems. This led to, at first, a proposal called the August Manifesto, because it was a set of promises that the Tsar offered in August to appease all the rebels. It was created by a guy called Alexander Bulyagin. And it said that the Tsar would create a Duma being a parliament, It did, though, say that the Duma would only be advisory. It wouldn't actually have any powers. It could just advise the Tsar on what to do, but couldn't make him do anything. And the votes would favour the peasants and urban workers, and kind of do be done proportionately to give them more of a voice. And as an example, Jews, who were kind of prominent in the middle class part of this revolution, not uniquely by any means, but they were banned from it. So it's seen as a kind of way of marginalising the middle class and those for greater political freedoms, to go more for the economic ones. Now, most Russians hated it. Okay, they really, really didn't like it. Mainly for some people, it went too far. For most, though, it just didn't go far enough. It certainly didn't meet their demands. The workers wanted more money, the peasants wanted more money and better conditions, the middle class wanted an actual strong set of rights, a constitution, and a Duma with some powers. So after this manifesto, they say no, and there's a general strike. So the urban workers shut down most Russian industry, including the transport. So this is going to exacerbate all those economic problems. Food is not going to get into the cities. A minister called Sergei Witte is recalled, and he's made chairman of the Council of Ministers, and the Tsar's getting pretty desperate. And Witte basically says, okay, Tsar, you got two options. Either military rule, or we have to give concessions. And you'll have to give up some of your autocracy and some of your power. Now, the military rule, the Tsar, that's what the Tsar would have wanted, but that was out because the army was trapped all the way over in Port Arthur, over near Korea. So that was out. So he's going to have to make concessions. This is going to be hard for the Tsar. And so what we then get is something called the October Manifesto. And the October Manifesto will go much further than the August one. It will guarantee basic freedoms. Now, nothing compared to what we're used to in the modern world, but basic freedoms like free speech, a free press, freedom of political association and having political parties. These will all be brand new things in Russia. It would also give the Duma the power to approve laws. Okay, so still advisory in many ways, but it now has the power to approve and therefore reject the laws that the Tsar wants to pass. So the Tsar comes up with them and says, right, here's the law that I want, but then the Duma has to rubber stamp it. So that is going to give them some power and remove some of the autocracy or the total power that the Tsar has. And they also say all classes, everyone should have the right to vote. Okay, so that's what's proposed by Witte in the October Manifesto. And that does enough to siphon off the middle classes. The middle classes, social revolutionaries, social democrats as well, they sort of say, and liberal supporters, they go, yay, this is great. We like this. And without their support, kind of the whole thing falls apart. The revolution in 1905 falls apart. So the general strike is ended because it looks like the Tsar's made these big concessions. Most of the liberals, kind of those middle classes, felt they got enough. Some of the more radical liberals felt it didn't go far enough, but you know, baby steps and so on. But by splitting the liberal opposition, it was enough. The socialists and people like Trotsky, they denounced the whole thing. And so these St. Petersburg Soviet under Trotsky's rule, that remains a thing of these workers' councils, these socialist revolutionaries trying to force much more change to create a system of equality or much better conditions for the workers. Trotsky at this stage is not a Bolshevik or communist, he's a socialist. Now, what this does lead to is new parties. So because you're going to have elections, you're going to have a Duma being established that's got some powers, new parties are set up. And this again is going to split the middle classes because now they've got some power, they're going to start arguing with each other. The two main ones were a moderate right-wing Union Party and a slightly more radical liberal party called the Cadet Party. For the GCSE course, you don't need to remember any of that. And that again splits the opposition, divide and conquer. And the cadets would refuse to work with the socialists. So again, the opposition is further divided and won't work with each other. At the same time, the Union of Russian People was created as another right-wing counterparty, and that was there to defend orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationality. So very much a small C conservative counteraction that would promote the Tsar and traditional ways of doing things. Created a group called the Black Hundreds that would target Jews and launch pogroms. So that's going to lead to a mass exodus of Jews from Russia at this time that would be supported by the government ministries of the interior and other union parties. So, you know, it's a conservative reaction to the revolutions. Also, as a result of these reforms, the army, because the general strike's over, the Trans-Siberian Railway's up and running, and the army comes back in force. And as soon as they come back in force, they basically crush the St. Petersburg Soviet, ending the socialist opposition, and they give up because they become divided and they can't stand up to it. The Moscow Soviet, because it's city-based, that would continue with the general strike and weapons, and the army just suppressed it, killing 1,000 people in the process. So we see the importance of the military being there to help the Tsar overcome the 1905 revolution. Now, in terms of where we go from here, well, for the Tsar, by the end of 1905, the regime had been secured again and actually was a lot stronger than it had been earlier in the year and even in July when this all kicked off. So in that sense, it was almost a meaningless revolution. He managed to win over the support of what were called the Octoberists, people who supported the October Manifesto, and it had split the liberal and socialist opposition. Working class Soviets had been crushed and destroyed, and as far as he was concerned, removed as a problem. And the five key elements had remained loyal, even if the army had been out of it for the time being. And once they were back and regained their strength, he had those five elements of power. Also, because you had the right-wing counterparty, he's now got a clear group of vocal, committed supporters who are going to back him. And that gives him more confidence and more confidence in his regime. However, the countryside was still an utterly chaotic mess. And legalization of trade unions and political parties meant that there now were alternative groups in Russia, and it was perfectly legal to be critical of the Tsar and to raise questions. So though it might not seem much, that's a big change. And what we have now with the existence of a Duma, with the existence of these rights, in principle at least, there is some limitation on the Tsar now. He has lost some of his autocracy, his total power. And that is going to be what really causes a long-term problem, because he's not going to accept that. And this is what I'll look at in the next episode, because I'm about half an hour now, is after 1905, up to World War One, and then during World War One, he's basically going to try and ignore the October Manifesto. He's going to try and marginalise the Duma. He's going to try and ignore the rights. And basically, as far as he's concerned, go back to a system of total autocracy. But having created trade unions, having created and allowed parties to exist, and having made these promises, he raises up expectations from the people. And as a result of that, although 1905 on its own might not seem a big deal, it is a precursor, and his failure to respect it and actually to try and undermine the October Manifesto is going to be one of the reasons why in 1917 no one will trust him to make the necessary reforms, and he's going to be forced to resign. So it's a useful bit of context and background knowledge. So just to conclude this bit from 1905, the regime had remained strong and powerful, but it had become limited through the October Manifesto. It was the champion. It had won in the 1905 revolution, but it had been given a long-term injury, and that long-term injury will prove fatal when World War One comes along to exacerbate it. But that is for the next episode. So I hope that was useful. Like I say, for those of you doing GCSE, mostly background information, but I hope it maybe gives you some context and understanding of the situation. Next time, depending on how the time goes, I'm going to be looking at the Tsarist recovery up to 1914 and then the impact of World War One. So I hope you enjoyed, and enjoy this little sojourn into Russian history. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll speak to you again soon. Goodbye.